Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Good afternoon. This is the Reasonable Voices radio show. Welcome. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando. My guest today is a very exciting and a brand new friend of mine. She is Yvette LaVere Graham. Yvette, did I pronounce everything correctly?
Well, you know, I've been called almost everything. As a matter of fact, in school, I had a classmate whose name was Elsie Bacon Lovering.
Ah.
And we were known all through the 6 years that we were in school together as Bacon and Liver. So you can do lots of things with LaVar.
Yvette LaVere Graham. And Yvette LaVere Graham has had what we both refer to as a good life. And she and I have spoken before on the radio, but also in person and at lunch, and have said, you know, maybe we'll do this a little more, maybe once a month on radio. Because as we talk about our lives, hers and mine, which we admit were not only good lives, but in some cases charmed lives and blessed lives for sure, but not without tragedy, and we will talk about that too. Yvette is right of center politically, as I am left of center politically, and I love all of our conversations, not so much because we agree on everything, but because we are talking and listening to one another, and we think maybe once a month we might just do that and allow you to listen in and maybe email questions or thoughts. I'll give that email now, thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. I'll give it several times during the show. But first, let's start with my good friend and guest today, Yvette LaVere Graham. Yvette was first married to James Cornelius Ruddle, Jr., who was sadly killed in the Korean War, and then she was married later to William Worth Graham III. And her father, you might well have know of, was William LaVere Jr. Now, he was born in 1898 and is the author of several books, actually, bestsellers. The one you might know the best because the film was made out of it. The film was called Papillon. But what was the title of the book, Yvette?
The book was titled Dry Guillotine, which is, of course, a French way of disposing of what one wants to dispose of. So that was what it was. As a matter of fact, I remember meeting him. His name was, but I remember he was a little Frenchman with a little black mustache. And the reason he was so famous was he was the only one who ever escaped from Devil's Island.
Exactly, exactly. And as usual...
René Delvenois, there we go.
Yes.
That's the thing about it. You talk about my father's age, you'll know mine when I remember things.
Well, Yvette, let's start back a few years. Let's start with your first marriage and to James and what happened. And, of course, the Korean War started, and I believe you were in Japan at the time, the two of you.
Correct.
And what happened after that?
Well, the reason that we were both in Japan Japan. It was Jim's first assignment from graduating from West Point. We'd been to school at Fort Benning, Georgia, and we'd been to Fort Riley, Kansas, and there was another one that he went to. And this was his first assignment. Well, it just happened to be overseas. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, at that time, you didn't send wives along with husbands.
Yes.
So I stayed in Seattle after seeing him off with my uncle and was doing some modeling, so I had something to do, which was lovely fun, until all of a sudden I couldn't fasten my skirt. And I thought, well, I'm eating too well or something. So, you know, about 2 months later, I realized why I couldn't fit into my skirt and went back to stay with my parents until Uncle Sam decided, and it had to be before 6 months or 7 months, I had to get over to Japan, which I was able to do. I finally got over there. So big fat mama, he left this lovely little skinny girl, and this great big thing came rolling into the Haneda Airport. So, that's life.
But not from overeating.
No, I was not from overeating, which truly relieved my mind, because I didn't think I was eating very much. Well, that's the thing about modeling. You know, that's the most important thing, that you keep looking up and keep your figure. So it kept me busy. It kept me busy till I left for Japan.
And I would like to, I'll mention this only because I know Yvette is not embarrassed by it. She is knockout gorgeous at 86. And I didn't know she had been a model, but now that I know, I'm not at all surprised. And of course, she lives and suggests and promotes a healthy lifestyle of exercise and the right kind of food, and she's just a marvelous person. But we have lots more incredibly interesting things about Yvette herself, but also about the men in her life. Tell us, you know, we see old war movies and we think we know history. I often say to people, I love history, but Yvette is history. And you have lived it. What, my earth, I hate the questions, what did it feel like, but what was it like to be pregnant? You join your new husband you hadn't seen in a bit, and he hadn't seen you pregnant, and there you are in Japan, and suddenly life changes. Tell us about that.
Indeed it did. Well, I got off a nonstop flight from San Francisco to Tokyo on three different airplanes. The nonstop didn't exactly pan out. The first one, we came into Hawaii with three engines going only, and they had to fix the fourth one, so we waited, and they put us on another one, which took off, circled, and landed again, because something didn't work again. And so by the third time I took off, which was the following day, I got as far as Wake Island, and then they only had one engine working. And at this stage of the game, I was ready to call my husband and say, come and get me, but you can't do that at the Air Force. So we waited until they brought the same Cotty that I was on from San Francisco. They fixed it and brought it into Wake and took us back into Japan. So that was a rather horrendous time getting there. And then, of course, we took the train to Jim was stationed on the lower island of Kyushu, and you could only get there by train, and so it had a nice sleeper on it. Well, can you imagine sleeping in a Japanese sleeper with an American pregnant wife when you're 6'2"? That was my introduction to Japan, but he had a good sense of humor, and as it turned out, we were assigned a beautiful set of quarters, which we've truly enjoyed, with a garden on one side and a pond on the other with ducks in it, and the ducks would go out into the middle of the island in the middle of the pond and lay their eggs, and then Nishimura, who was the lawn man that took care of it, pull on his boots and walk out to the island and pick up the fresh eggs and bring them back for my breakfast. It's not all bad.
I was going to say, it's a charmed life.
You laugh at it. Looking back, you laugh.
Yes. But, so there you were. How much time did you have with James, or Jim, you know, married, pregnant, and duck eggs, and a nice, you know.
There was no real hospital in Beppu, which is a resort city in Japan. They had hot sulfur springs there. So that in our house, we had three humongous bathtubs, one for the owner one for the children, and the next one is for the housekeepers.
Ah.
So that you had the hottest water to begin with, and the housekeeping, theirs was a little cooler and a little dirtier. But it was a fun time. And I had to go up at the hospital, which was at Fukuoka, over on the other side of the island. We had to drive over there 2 weeks before my due date, which turned out to be 3 weeks before my due date. So we did a lot of bouncing around, hoping to bring it on. And the 2nd of May, after 29 hours, the dig arrived. My husband, that's a term at West Point, you dig somebody, they get gigs. And so he named his son, nicknamed his son Dig, which happened, you know, right away.
Uh-huh.
And then we went back afterwards, back to Beppu, about the middle of May, and began to have a normal life with a squalling baby that you didn't know how to take care of. But, by the 4th of, after he left, the Korean War broke out, and we were with the 24th Division in Beppu, and the 19th Infantry Regiment, and we were the closest American military to Korea. So General MacArthur decided we better get over there in a big cash hurry, which they did. And by the 27th of June only, they were gone. And, that was sort of the beginning of that end. So they went over, and when they came back, with the guys over there all had to sign a pay sheet because there were all these wives back in Beppu, and I was standing in line with the rest of them. And when I got up to pick up my goodies, they just looked down and said, "Yvette, we are so terribly sorry." And that was how I found out that it was going to be a one-way ticket.
Oh, my God. Just like that? That's how you found out? What year was this?
This is still 1950.
Yeah.
Because, you see, they just got over there, and they were overwhelmed. None of this I knew until the prisoners of war were released after the war was over and came back and then reported what had happened. And where, who was where, and what Jim had done, and all that sort of stuff. But it was, it was chaotic.
Yes.
They went over there, and they were just not prepared for what was going to happen, and they had to turn around and get out. Well, somebody had to hold line while they got out, so
yes.
Jim did it. So his grandson has his Congressional Medal Star, which is what you get instead. But that's life, isn't it?
Yes. I want to mention, because I was really touched by this the first time we talked, and that you went to the Bethesda Naval Hospital, and while you were waiting to hear about your first husband, Jim, and you didn't.
Right.
And what did you do at the Bethesda Naval Hospital? Tell us that.
When I came back, I mean, they were very kind. They bundled us all up, and my son did not have a passport nor anything because they hadn't gotten down at the airfield so fast, and knowing absolutely nothing except that they were bringing home the wounded to Bethesda Naval Air Station, the hospital there, which is a beautiful naval hospital. So I thought, well, maybe I could pick up some information there. I wasn't able to get it anyplace else. You know, MIA covers the multitude of sins.
Yes.
So I used to go, I went over the first day just chit-chattering with the boys, and they were all in good spirits, and I thought, well, let's see, what are we going to do about this? So the next week, I took those little airplanes that you put together, little wooden airplanes with rubber bands on them, and I took a dozen of those, I guess, and handed them out, and the guys were having fun fixing that. Well, the next week I came, and of course they'd been shooting them all over the place.
Yeah.
And I think the nurses were out of their minds. But this time I had a load of ring tosses. So all the guys that had an arm sticking up or a leg sticking up, all the ones that didn't, that were slapped in bed, were trying to get the rings over their feet or arms or their heads or whatever was sticking up. So that this was, I have no idea what the staff there thought of me, but it was, they were such nice kids,
yes.
And they just needed attention. So that's what I did. I would listen to them, and I'd write letters for them, and I'd make telephone calls for them. And when, you know, when I got home, just I just felt as though, you know, everybody wants to do their share for the floor, and this was my pleasure. It was my pleasure, which made me feel a lot better, knowing that maybe somebody was taking care of my gym someplace.
Tell us now about William Worth Graham III was your second husband, and I understand he waited around for you even through your first marriage. Yes.
Well, you know, I had known him since I was 7 years old. As a matter of fact, I bear a scar on my leg where he chased me up the stairs, and there was a nail sticking out. Oh. I tripped on it, and of course, at the age of 8, the screaming bloody murder. Yes. And he was a nervous wreck being a young teenager that he'd caused it. So we didn't have the best of beginnings, but we both liked to crab and we both liked to sail. But, you know, we got to be friends over the years, and it turned out that the reason he was up there in the first place, his cousin, several times removed, was the head of the school that I went to, the Hewitt School. So very often, because he had lost his father in the First World War, his mother would send him up to fish and crab and all the good things that we did there, because my parents were out of the country, which is why I was there. So we kind of grew up as brothers and sisters and did things together, and then things got a little advanced, and I got older, and he got older, and he went into the Air Corps, the Army Air Corps, and I will never forget, nor will anybody at school. I was probably a sophomore or junior, something like that, and we were out playing field hockey, which one does on Long Island, and all of a sudden, this C-45 bombed the hockey field, and he came down and wiggled his wings and took off and came back and did his
Oh, wow.
He was just showing off.
Yes.
To the school. So I didn't realize that was him until he came to dinner that night, because he left his plane Long Island. And came in and announced that he had seen so-and-so had a good hockey shot and whatnot. We looked at him, we thought, you pie-faced mullet now. So we went to a couple of dances and things like that. And then, of course, this other man just slipped in between. You know, if Jim had not come along, I probably would have married William first. And if William had not been around, I would have married Jim. It was one of those things. I had the two most wonderful men in the world. And I couldn't be luckier in the fact that I'd have probably been married to Jim for 400 years too, but it didn't work out that way. So God was good to me. He gave me another one who came by one day after the prisoners had come back and everything was settled, and he popped in one day and said, "Well, I raised you, so I guess I'm going to have to marry you." And there you go. That's what happened.
Oh, and you and life certainly went on. I mean, you the two of you did amazing things and ended up right. Didn't you at one point grow Christmas trees? I know I'm jumping all over the place, but
that's going way on. First, in the meantime, from marriage to the Christmas trees, we again were assigned to Japan. And I went back again for my second child, his daughter, and we had two stations there, and then came back to Washington at Andrews, and there are stories about old things that happened in between that. Then we wound up in Atlantic City before he said, you know, this is ridiculous. We need to go home. The children need to know where home is.
Yes.
Which was when he gave up his first daughter, and the wing command at Fort Macon, Georgia. And we went home, and that was the beginning of the Christmas tree business, because when we came back from Japan the first time, when we bought our Christmas tree, they said, that'll be $75. We thought, really? So we bought the farm and thought, cows will get out, and they're a lot of work, so
yes.
We started planting Christmas trees because they didn't get out.
Yes,
later too, but it was a whole new life for a military man and a New York City girl. It was quite different.
Speaking of New York City, you went to boarding school, yes? With a wonderful principal and holidays at the Barclay in New York City, and learned how to knit bundles for Britain. I love that.
this was the end of the Second World War, really. And I was just a kid, and we had this marvelous teacher at school who could teach Latin and Greek and all sorts of things, but she was a little Canadian old Mickey. And she was probably 6 foot tall, and I don't think I ever saw her in anything except one beautiful tweed suit. But she decided that we were little girls and we were young ladies and we had to know how to do things. So she, when we would get chocolate kisses and Hershey bars that were always wrapped in aluminum foil, we would start making balls of those, and we would build them up to about, lacrosse ball size, and then we start another one. So we did that for Uncle Sam, and we all painted our legs stockings so we didn't have to use nylon. And she taught us how to knit bundles for Britain. And we all started out with little squares and then progressed to the point where by the time I had finished and the project was all over, I was knitting, I don't know what a trigger mitten to finger is or not, but it's a mitten with the thumb, but it also has the first finger. And the rest of them are mittens, and it goes up your arm under your uniform for the guys to be able to shoot without having to take their gloves off.
So
that was something that we were pretty pleased about doing. We had a very interesting time at that school. I really did. They taught us all sorts of little things that you don't normally have at school. And there were a lot of foreign girls from Latin America that would come to learn English and American ways, and there were always, we had Julie Trujillo one time, she was not in my class, she was in a lower one, but we always had people who were in the same boat that I was, their parents were not home to raise them, or they wanted them to learn American ways,
sure.
So that it was full of very interesting people that taught us how to do all sorts of different things. And being as close to New York as we were able to get to the ballet and the opera and all the good things that go on in New York, as well as have holidays, doing other things. So it was, my school days were wonderful. And to this day, my friend, who's a year older than I and a class ahead of me, is still my best friend and is living in Maryland.
Wonderful.
So we still keep in touch.
This, as I've said before, Yvette, your life is a good life. With what you've said to me, and I say it's a historic one as well. It's a real slice of what America was and continues to be in many ways. There are lots of changes, lots of transformation, but you give us a POV that I find inspiring and enlightening. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a bit more about Yvette's father, William LaVar Jr., born in 1898, author of many bestsellers, including like Southwood Ho.
Draw a Guillotine.
Yes. Draw a Guillotine, Diamonds and Orchards, Papillon's Devils, Island Escapee, Gold Diamonds, you know. Yeah, anyway, we'll be back for that. But I do want to mention again that Yvette and I are new and becoming fast new best friends, it seems to me. We have life stories we want to share, and we're thinking of doing that once a month on this radio show. And we invite you to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com, the kinds of things you might want to hear us talk about. We'll be right back. Stay with us, and it will be exciting to have you like us on Facebook. Stay with us.
And now, another film rental discovery. Welcome to the Andyville Minute. Adulthood could be defined as the process of learning to be shocked by things that do not shock teenagers. So said Roger Ebert in his review of today's selection, Heathers. We suspect that Heathers could be shocking to those looking for offense, but for those who enjoy a black comedy with coming-of-age angst, here are a few guffaws that will knock you out of your easy chair. The title refers to a trio of popular mean girls all named Heather, who rule their high school by cruelly humiliating those they deem less deserving. A precursor to the culturally iconic Mean Girls, Heathers stars Winona Ryder as teenage Veronica on the edge of the popular girl clique and quietly suffering their cruelty. And Christian Slater, when he was still hailed as the next Jack Nicholson, is J.D., the 60s cool new student who will not put up with bullies. Both earn their raves here in a collaboration of innocence and evil who determine to wipe out all the cruel kids who ever tortured us, them, in high school. Remember those pesky morals that kept us from attacking the mean girls in our lives? JD doesn't have them. Heathers, an all-time favorite. Not in theaters, Discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices radio show this Monday afternoon. I am talking to my guest and new favorite friend, Yvette Lavar Graham, who has had quite a good life. And part of that comes from her father and mother. But let's talk about her mother a bit first, Alice Lavar. And what is she most famous for?
Probably walking a mile for a Camel cigarette.
Yes.
I remember, we're back at the Mommy and Daddy, because they met when my mother was first reader for Liberty Magazine, and Daddy was, of course, this is all hearsay, I wasn't there.
That's right.
Daddy had a syndicate of newspapers in Columbia, South Carolina. And he was up on business in New York and met my mother at Liberty and decided, I was a pretty cute chick. And eventually they married and he stopped traveling at that stage of the game with the newspapers. And they moved to South Carolina, where I was born, although my mother was a New Yorker and said, I'm going to have this baby in New York. So she went up to, so I was born in New York in Harkness Pavilion and delivered by one of the most marvelous doctors in the world, Jean Corwin, who's gone now, but she was my idol for many years, and we'll mention that later on.
Sure.
But at that stage of the game, Daddy, somebody wanted his papers or something, and they had a hell of a fight and went to court, and he finally won the case, but lost the newspapers and decided to go back traveling again. This was not what my mother had married, but they did it all the right way. They had good backing, Anthony Fiala, and so I was taken to stay at the age of three, a very nice family out in the Marinette, Long Island, New York, not Long Island. And I was there for 3 years, and they finally decided I needed to go to school, so they came home, and I was taking a fabulous shopping trip at the age of seven, and was whisked off to boarding school, which I was all excited about, except about 5 minutes after my father went in to get me in my bags, he came out, got in the car, and we took off. But I was heartbroken, absolutely heartbroken, but I will tell you the rest of that later after a while. So we wound up with a new one at Hewlett, Long Island, and they went back to work in the jungles. Before they had married, Daddy had been the number one Boy Scout in the United States. And as a prize, Teddy Roosevelt, he was not president at the time, but Teddy Roosevelt took him on a trip across the Isthmus of Panama, and he was so fascinated with it that he did 2 years in Harvard classes and 2 years in Latin America studying and working. And just fell in love with that area and wrote his first book at that time, Up the Mazaruni for Diamonds. Now, this was before that they were married, and then that kind of, he got into the newspaper business. So this is what they went back to. And in a bigger way, this time he had a wife and Arab, their Great Dane, that went on it too. Mm-hmm. And they were on the Great Flying Ship going down with their entourage and went into the jungles and discovered all sorts of things and brought animals back to the National Zoo. And my mother advertised, this was the thing that I started to tell you, one of their sponsors was Camel Cigarette Ads.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a picture of the Rover Zero, I can remember very well, in the funny papers in color, my mother, with the sign saying, I would walk a mile for a camel. Well, she's got a .45 on her hip. There's a jaguar skin behind her. She's got a foot up on a stupid bench, and her pith helmet is pulled down just enough so you can see the cigarette smoke coming out of her mouth. I guess it sold Camel cigarettes, but the funny part of it, my father's great uncle Jim's last name, owned a Chesterfield company. So that was
yes.
Things happen in families like this. But he continued writing books, and they continued traveling, and he wrote, I guess after Up the Mazaruni was the next one was A Faded Woman, which was a little off the beaten path, but it's old, and then he started writing about Latin America and their trips down there.
Mm-hmm.
And the first really big seller was Gold, Diamonds, and Orchids.
Yes.
It was full of Indian princesses and humongous waterfalls. He was a photographer as well as a writer.
Yes.
As was his brother, who very often went along with him on the trip to do some of the pictures. But it was the first time. What was the name of it? The Johnsons? Weren't they the ones that took all the pictures in Africa? Well, the Lavars did it all in Latin America, and it was fascinating. And he also was writing Boy's Life, Johnny Round the World, and into the children's thing. So that it was not just for adults that he was writing. And I swear, anything I've ever read of Daddy, he sounded like a Boy Scout, and he sounded like he was talking to a Boy Scout. But that's probably why they stole.
Sure.
So afterwards, the next big one was Southward Ho.
Yes.
This was, I can't remember if this was before Dry 18 or not, but now we're getting into the point where the war is on again, the Second World War. And
yes.
The problem was that we didn't have any rubber, which you may remember. We didn't have any nylon stockings, and we didn't have any rubber tires, and we rationed shoes, and so they decided to send Daddy, who by this time was an expert on Latin America, down to find and make arrangements for rubber.
Mm-hmm.
So he went down to Manaus, which was not very big, and made all these plans. At that time, he was Under Secretary of Commerce with Jesse Jones.
Yes.
And he got all the paperwork done and came back, and they had discovered plastic rubber.
Wow.
So he had quite a time down there, but it was not necessary anymore. And then after that, he started writing, speech writing for people, and he was editor of Mercury Magazine, and he and I'm trying to think of the name of Reader's Digest. He wrote a lot of stories for Reader's Digest because they were very good friends of his.
Mm-hmm.
So he never stopped writing.
Yes.
But eventually, you know, they grew older and didn't travel around as much and retired in North Carolina mountains, and they just loved it, and that's where they stayed until the end.
Well, they were quite a set of parents, let me tell you. William LeVar Jr., author, and Alice LeVar, at the very least, the camel's lady. And I remember that. I do remember that ad, seeing that on TV as a kid. I do.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson wanted her, too, because Mommy was quite a ravishing beauty. And,
yes.
And before, Edith Head helped her before. They did all these things when they went down to make movies in Latin America on their trips. They were very photogenic, which is where I thank you for what you said, thank them for what they did.
Well, I have to tell you, right along, because I do remember that commercial on television as a kid, and as I said, my number one passion, or crush, I guess I should say, in those days was Annette Funicello, but your mother was a close second because I didn't know who she was. But when you described, and I'm just realizing this, because when you described how the pit hat was and the smoke and whatever, I remember I remember she was a close second to Annette of my watching the Mickey Mouse Club. So there's another way we are connected, in any case.
Well, Mommy didn't have big black ears, but she did start with a friend of hers. As a matter of fact, was the wife of the man that drew Daddy's cartoons, Diane Underwood. They started the Little Red Door, which was not a perfume company, but it was the beginning of the cancer program.
Yes.
And they started that in the 40s, and Mommy did quite a bit of work for them, along with Ella Rigney. So... they all kept their fingers in the pie. And
yes. So what happened? We've talked so much about your husbands and your parents and through them you too, of course. But what happened to you in 2014 that was a bit of a scare and you came through it? And do you mind sharing some of that with us?
2014.
You were in the hospital, yes?
That's funny how you remember some things and try and forget other things. I had a little problem feeling one evening I was fine, and the next minute I wasn't, and they rushed me off to the hospital, and that wasn't a big enough one, so they shot me over to Martha Jefferson, which is just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was met by the chief surgeon there. He happened to be on duty that night, and he said, "I'll see you downstairs in 20 minutes." So I had a bit of a problem that had to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
But the doctor was addressing it, and quite frankly, I was beginning a new life, I guess, because they almost lost me. And I remember, you know, you hear about people and these programs, but I can tell you, I was down standing someplace and looking down this darkened tunnel, and at the end of the tunnel, there was somebody standing there in a doorway that was all white, so he was the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, William, I had a good life. Jim, I'm coming back. Mm-hmm. And then I've had it, you know, this is fine. And then I got to thinking about my great-granddaughter that was on the way.
Mm.
So I said, you know what, let's make it later. And that was the beginning of my second life alone, but it was, it's quite an eye-wakener. Is that what you were talking about?
Yes, yes. I'm so glad you stayed. You know that there's a film called If I Stay, but to hear you tell that story, I knew about that, that you had been through that, and that's not terribly long ago, but the thought of your great-grandchild is what made you decide to stay. It's a beautiful story.
That's absolutely true, yeah. I knew the two guys were waiting for me. That was fine, but William was never going to see his great-grandchild, and I thought, well, I have to tell you about her, so I guess I better go back and take a good look at her before.
Yes.
Yeah, so. And she's adorable, of course.
Yes, yes. Well,
I can't go by a store that I don't stick my nose in anything that has children's clothes in it, and I never come out empty-handed. You
of
know?
Course not.
That routine.
Well, I have to say, it's been a glorious life. You know, and I am so happy to have met you. And we, again, I want to touch on everyone. The email address is thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. Yvette and I have known each other for only a couple of months, I guess. But every conversation seems to draw us closer to one another. And
I hope so.
Yes, and I'm particularly happy because, as I said at the beginning of the show, Yvette and I are thinking about maybe once a month, the Reasonable Voices will be she and I having a conversation about our lives with the idea of stimulating questions about where we are now as a people. One of the many, many things I love about Yvette LeVar Graham is that she and I can talk to one another because we listen to one another. It's not necessary that we Americans all agree about everything. There's so much differences of opinion on the, you know, what the First Amendment really means, what the Second Amendment really means, and what flags mean, etc., that everyone's screaming, and not just on television, but on the streets and in campaigns and whatever. And I just think it's, we got this idea, Yvette and I, by talking to each other at lunch. And
over a gorgeous bowl of soup.
And salad. She's determined to keep me in shape, too. she and my wife, I tell you. But it was wonderful soup. She wouldn't let me get garlic bread. Wonderful salad. And we will do it again many times. But I point out the politics only because it, to me, proves what can be done, that bridges are there, and that our infrastructure is more than the physical stuff. Our infrastructure really are our children and our willingness to listen to one another and be civil with one another and seek solutions. I always say you can start with perfection, but then you compromise from there. So I just want to say again, for those who might not have heard, how would you describe yourself, Yvette? Maybe you don't need me to speak for you. I'm sure you don't.
Well, you speak much better than I do for me. I'm just a good American. I have opinions. I listen. You know, you said that. I think if more people would listen and shoot off their faces, if you'll pardon my French,
yes,
we might be a happier group of people. Because
yes,
what you hear from people, it's really rather nice that you wouldn't know if you didn't listen.
Exactly.
I'm all for chitter-chattering. We do enjoy it.
Yes.
You don't have to agree, but you have to exchange.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the word. Exchange. Listen. Share.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Be civil. I hate to use that old cliche my grandmama used, but there's a reason you have two ears and one mouth. but it is, for instance, the other day on Facebook, I had we've corresponded on Facebook before. I've never met him, but he clearly is an extremely conservative, politically conservative man, probably middle-aged, judging by his picture, but incredibly intelligent. And when we communicate, the last thing I saw of his, I responded to something he had written, and I said, well, I agree with you 95%, Carl, which is what usually happens, right up until you assign the reason for this on victim mentality. I think that's a dangerous phrase. I know what it means. I know it's been around a while. I know there are a lot of professional medical people who have expressed their opinions on it, but labels are things that I think get us into trouble. And his response was, you know, 95% is not bad, Marcello. It's that only that 5% that separates the conservative from the liberal. We all want the same things. And I just, you know, I'm just so moved by that. But anyway, back to Yvette. That's why Yvette is a conservative Republican. I believe that's fair to say. I'm a liberal something. I don't know that I always call myself a liberal Democrat, but I'm certainly a liberal left of center independent something. And when we talk, Yvette and I, about anything, I think we discover everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. But there is a growing fear that breeds anger in the country that is being manipulated, I think, in many ways by many different factions. And I think when people just stop long enough to do two things, they think for themselves rather than letting media or political party think for them, and they listen to other points of view, they will discover beautiful people like Yvette. You know, that's really.
I don't know about that, but I do know. I can't call myself a Republican, a Democrat, a liberal, or anything. I don't fit into any of those categories, or I fit into all of them.
Yes.
I think that their politics has misnamed people's viewpoint.
Yes,
and
I agree.
And we are not. We're not what they say we are.
That's right.
And I think that this is something that has created by learning, and I don't think we're teaching children in school how to learn or how to want to learn and how to make decisions, how to listen and draw your own conclusions.
Yes.
And that's what I think of as politics, the people who draw their own conclusions to what they hear, but they don't hear it all. They just hear what they want to hear.
Yes.
This is a problem.
Yes.
This is a problem.
Well, we're going to, I will be hosting other guests as usual, at least three Mondays a month. But the more I think about it, and I'm sort of asking Yvette on air, but we did sort of discuss it the other day over lunch. I'm going to try and have Yvette LeVar Graham, my dear friend, my dear new friend, on the show once a month. And we're not going to be on the show to talk about politics, and certainly not to argue about politics. We're going to talk about life and relationships and history and America and education, and then and through those subjects, especially if you send us emails with specifics you'd like us to talk about. The idea is, I think, when you hear what unity there is, that maybe it will be contagious. Maybe other people will start talking to one another and listening. But education is key.
That sounds like a great idea. I assume that this is a proposal, but my third proposal will be...
That's right.
I can't think of anyone I'd rather talk to than you, Marcello.
Well, thank you so much, and we will do this. We're going to close today's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you've enjoyed the potential of our doing, Yvette and I doing this again, and that you will join us by giving us talking points at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com, and we'll try to discuss those. But I think I'm hearing from Yvette something that I feel. All of our problems are solved if we educate objectively, equal education, and if we listen to each other and have civil conversations. I think that's only beautiful things can happen. We've come a long way as a country, and there's no reason for us to fall apart because we're suddenly, someone's convinced us we are two halves instead of one whole. Anyway, let's let Yvette have the final word before we go. Anything you want to add, Yvette?
Well, my goodness. New in me. I thought my husband always had the final word, so I'm delighted. I missed them both, but I thank Marcello for giving me the final word. And there's some things that I've done that you might be interested in, and I do hope that you will give us an idea about what you think, not just what we think.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks, Marcello.
Exactly. Thank you. And again, thereasonablevoice@gmail.com, and we'll always be including everyone because Yvette and I are all inclusive. Thanks, Yvette. You have a wonderful time. We will talk again soon, I promise. Bye now.
Bye.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. It started in 1993 with Pure Evil. 3 8-year-old boys found hogtied and butchered in West Memphis, Arkansas. 3 teenagers arrested, clearly drunk on sinister music and devil worship, exuding satanic presence. 1 even confessed. Kill them, cried the community. Guilty, said the police, the prosecutor, the judge. 4 documentary films tell of the same horrifying events. Paradise Lost, Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills was the first, a standalone masterpiece that provides incredible insights from every side. The police, the families, the prosecutors, the judge, and the defendants. A simple story no more. Guilt settled. Truth in question. 2 sequels update the story. New revelations, new questions. A miscarriage of justice? Likely. Did we need a 4th film? Absolutely. The first tells the hideous tale in real time as it unfolds. With the benefit of hindsight, West of Memphis fills in the rest of the story. The real story. Ultimately, the West Memphis 3 were released after 18 years on an Alford plea, which asserts innocence while acknowledging damning evidence. Face saving for the system and justice for none.
Paradise Lost, and West of Memphis. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of The Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.